On today's episode of Secrets of Home Builders, Pat Cardone interviews Marty Paris, owner of Sedgwick Development. Marty details his story of how he became one of Chicago's leading developers and contractors in the city of Chicago.
Hi, this is Pat with SG Home Builders. I'm here with Marty Paris from Sedgwick Development, and we're going to talk about the market and the Home Builders Association and all kinds of stuff. Marty, why don't you tell us how you started in this business and what your path has been?
Well, I started in the business back in the late 90s. We were doing rehab projects in Lincoln Park and Lakeview. Shortly after battling through the ills of rehabbing, we started buying land and doing ground-up construction in the early 2000s. Projects in Lincoln Park, Lakeview, South Loop.
So your stuff in Lincoln Park when you started, that was just like condos, or was it two flats, or what was it doing? Single families?
They were all multi-unit, four units or bigger.
So you cut your teeth on the problem stuff first.
Yeah, cut the teeth on the problem stuff. And most of those we held as rentals. And I was doing that in moonlighting in that work when I still had a full-time job. And then once we started selling condos, that's when we kind of incorporated the business and started doing it full-time.
Right. So, I mean, did you look at this from the beginning like this was going to be your full-time job, or was it really part-time in the beginning? I mean,
Really more just for investment. It was an investment play.
Right. So you were just looking for ways to keep your money moving and have some other ways to have an income.
Exactly.
That's cool. So I know you've been doing a ton of projects in the city. What do you see coming up here in the city? I know we got 60 cranes going on right now. What do you see in the city in terms of growth over the next few years, especially if these tax cuts, which are supposed to be passed today, come through? Do you think we're going to have a boom in the market?
Well, certainly on the apartment side, the market's already well into the boom. And the question is how many innings into the game are we on the apartment side? Most people believe we're late in the game.
Right.
The question is, will we see extra innings, or is it going to really start decelerating? I think because the amount of supply going in the apartment market, we're going to see a slowdown in the apartment market. And then I think it will spike again, and I think the next wave will be even more significant and more tower cranes, but it's probably 3 or 4 years away.
So you think we gotta have a slowdown to absorb what we've got now, then it's going to come back?
Exactly. The capital markets are all very concerned about the amount of supply coming on. If the capital markets aren't investing in deals, you know, if you're unable to capitalize them and finance them, you really can't do more deals. So I think we'll see a lull coming up 2 or 3 years, which is good because we've got an oversupply coming on this spring. It'll take a bit for that oversupply to be absorbed, and then we'll see another big wave. The for sale market, I think we're going to see continued acceleration. It's really the for sale market before the recession from, you know, early 90s all the way to 2007 was 3,000 to 4,000 units a year.
Right.
Delivered and 3,000 to 4,000 units a year sold. And it was fairly balanced, was selling, you know, almost evenly from quarter to quarter, about 1,000 units a quarter. Right now, the for sale market, we're delivering like 500 units.
Well, sort of like half of what it was.
Not half, like 10% almost. 10%, you know,
okay.
Between
10 and 20%
for the year.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean, it's really non-existent.
Yeah.
And the only price point in the market is the high end.
Right. That's just cost of construction.
It's cost of construction, but it's also that the developers are not seeing the millennials come in as buyers.
Right.
The millennials want the same product we were delivering to the 20-something, 30-something wants the same product we were delivering from the mid-90s to the late 2000s.
Right.
But in the mid-90s from the late 2000s, they were buyers, and now they're renters, right?
Right.
So
right.
You've seen...
It's Back to the Future.
Well, you know, I heard someone describe the millennials, and I think it was probably a pretty good description, right? They want to rent their unit. They want to rent their furniture. They want to rent their car.
Right.
They want to rent
their
girlfriend and maybe
and
just
about
anything
else. No responsibility.
So the truth
is,
they
want it all.
The truth is they're still probably paying about $3,000 a month for housing.
Yeah.
They're just paying it in rent as opposed to a mortgage. So,
where do you see that change coming? I mean, this is almost a generational shift in thinking.
I think it really is a generational shift in thinking, but I think the pendulum tends to swing, right? And from the early 90s to the mid 2000s before the recession, it had swung way to a for sale market and almost no apartment development.
Right.
And now it's swung completely back the other direction. So I think we'll see, as they call it, kind of a regression to the mean, which would mean less renters and more home buyers.
Right.
I also think the millennials are at a an age in their life where there's a lot of transition, and it's more practical to be a renter as much as I...
Well, it seems to be a lot of job shifting nowadays, too. It, you know, when I grew up, it was like, you got a job, you kind of ran with it.
Not to age you, right? But
well,
I think the job shifting's probably been a 20-year phenomenon.
Yeah.
And so I think that continues, and that continues to feed into the renter profile.
Right.
I think also the downturn really put a spotlight and highlighted the fact that although real estate is a good investment, it's not always a good investment in a 3 to 5 year increment. So if you're in a point in your life where there's transition,
that's a good
real
point.
Estate impacts your ability to transition and to move.
Absolutely.
Selling a piece of real estate has real transactional cost, takes real time, and impacts your ability to be able to transition quickly. So I think the millennial population, by good judgment and thought and analysis or just by chance, probably has that part of it a little bit figured out. But certainly when you start having...
Or is it a result of also the crash? Because you think they grew up in households seeing this and now they don't want... a part of this yet. They don't feel confident in the system.
I think certainly there's some lack of confidence, right?
Yeah.
And or maybe a lack of the buzz, right? We're not in the environment right now, either in the stock market or the real estate market, where your cab driver's giving you stock tips cab driver's giving you housing tips, right?
Yeah,
but we were there in 2006 and 2007.
Yeah, absolutely. They were all investing.
They were all investing, right? So where we're seeing in our for sale deals, our buyer profile, among other things, being someone who's very countercyclical, somebody who is buying counter to the cycle, and what's going to happen with those folks. And we're seeing the product that's being delivered on the condo side, which is almost exclusively between $1 million and the sky's the limit, starting around $1 million typically. We're seeing that product increase in value by 20 or 30% from pre-sales to delivery.
Right.
So that creates a cycle, right? Because those folks that are counter-cyclical that will go against the cycle and make the purchase when not very many people are purchasing, you know, some of those will be telling the story how I bought it for $1 million and it was worth 1.7 when I closed.
Right.
Others will be telling the story as I bought it for $1 million and I got transferred to jobs and I had to sell it and I only made $600,000 unintentionally, right?
Right.
When
right.
that buzz gets out there, that brings the next guy into the cycle. How do I lose? If I buy and I move, I'll make $300 a foot.
Right.
And if I close, I made $300 a foot.
Right.
Now, the truth is when you get to that part of the cycle, that guy doesn't get that benefit.
No.
Or maybe the second guy does, but the third guy typically doesn't, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where the cycle breaks. But the counter-cyclical guys set in the base for the buzz that helps the next and the next move on. And we have a lot of space in the for sale market to grow, right? We're at between 10 and 20% of the median from 90s through the 2000s. So,
I mean, because if you're only talking 500 units a year, that's only 60, a month, basically. That's not a lot.
It's not a
market like this.
No, it's not a lot. Now, you noted earlier that it is expensive to build.
Yeah.
All the apartment construction has really driven up the cost of construction.
Yeah.
And these apartment deals are typically trading between $500 and $700 a foot. So the institutional...
Well, they're buying into them for more money than someone who's developing is, correct?
Well, the developer has to make the profit,
right?
So the next guy who buys it has to be willing to pay
to
the developer
that.
The profit
or
the deal doesn't happen. And that's driving inflation in the subcontractor market and driving inflation to the end user.
Right.
So,
well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, so in the long run, there's 60 cranes going, and we don't know how many, what that percentage is rentals. So how many of those guys?
Well, we also don't know how much of that is office too.
Well, exactly.
It could be 10 or 20 office deals too, because the office deals are going, hotels are going again, and then multifamily continues to be strong, and then some for sale. So my gut is there's probably about 10 for sale cranes up. There's probably about 10 office cranes, probably 20 apartment cranes, and maybe 10 hotel cranes.
Right. But it's good to see that there's market activity here. I mean, there's a lot of construction going on, which brings up, you know, we're both in the association. The builders, there's a shortage of workers.
A shortage of workers. Where we see that mostly is just trying to hire subcontractors to get stuff done. The subcontractors are the guys trying to recruit the workers, but it's a busy market, and it's driving inflation at the wage level of the...
You seeing increase on your subs?
We're seeing a ton of increases.
And multiple times a year, or just in...
Well, we usually set in a fixed price, but you're seeing a lot more...
But I'm just saying, if you're doing two or three projects a year, is the price the first project lower than the one at the end of the year? Not really?
You know, it's just not that fluid of a market.
Yeah.
You know, you'll get 10 guys give you a price that you just can't make the deal work for, and then you'll find the one guy who can make it work. And that may be 10 or 15% below where the rest of the market is.
Right.
So what that basically means is that the market's pricing in 15 or 20% extra profit.
Right.
I think the subcontractors right now, the typical subcontractor is marking in about 50% profit, and he's getting work with that.
Yeah.
So that's a huge profit margin. So more of the issue is subcontractors making bigger profit than it is what they're actually paying their workers.
Of course, it's not about the workers.
Yeah.
We know that.
And it's not really about the material cost.
No
materials. It's about the profit.
Yeah, so I mean, but that's all cooked in. So what do you think long term is going to happen here? I mean, how are we going to get back to a society where we actually get people going into the trades? I mean, I don't have an answer, you know?
I think there's always going to be... you know, a segment of the population that type of work appeals to, right? So that will never be gone, that base, right? But I think what we're finding is that base is too small to facilitate the amount of construction, certainly the amount of construction that's going on right now. It's a tough problem to solve in that it's hard to advise someone to go into trades with all the volatility that's in this industry.
Yeah.
If you're making your living building for sale housing or building apartment housing, you know,
it can change.
It's not a very stable living.
No, I mean, it can change in less than a year.
Right.
You can go from full employment to none. And that sucks. I mean,
right. We
know that. I mean, you've been through how many ups and downs you've been through in the market?
I've really only been through the big recession.
Yeah.
I started in the early 90s, and that was coming out of a downturn, but I didn't know the downturn.
It's almost better to not know, isn't it? You just go in with all full tilt boogie, you know?
You do, and it was a long run from the early 90s to 2007, and you know, there was a little blip in 2000 with September 11th and the tech crash.
Right.
But really, when we saw the tech crash, that was probably the strongest for sale market I remember.
Really?
People took their money out of the stock market because they're so disgusted by it and almost immediately put it into housing and to real estate. I remember we were absorbing, I mentioned earlier, about 1,000 units a year, the Chicago market. That's what the appraisal research counselors' reports would say. And it was pretty consistent.
Right.
1,100, 900 every quarter.
Right.
Every quarter, I should say, which would add up to 4,000 a year, right? In the first quarter of, September 11th was 2001. So in the first quarter of 2002, we saw net zero sales.
Oh,
but by the second quarter, it was back to 1,000.
Really?
So it was a 3 month.
That was it.
A 3 month blip.
That was it.
That just kind of stalled the market. But you know, in this side of the business, the 3 month blip isn't much. A 3 year blip?
Yeah,
that's a problem.
That's enough to kill you then.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Like, we've been through the blips. It's funny. How many times have you? I mean, you know, I always look at the way we do our business, and it's like we always have to be able to turn on a dime if we have to. How? I mean, you're obviously your type of business. You got a little bit longer turn times, you know, because we're doing single family. It's like, okay, 6 months you can turn.
Right.
You know, you guys, what is it? Year and a half that you can really change the projects and
deals. You know, our deal cycles are usually like 3 to 4 years. There's tough. Probably a whole year of pre-development. The apartment deal cycle tends to be shorter,
right?
But it depends where you stand on entitlements. If you have to go through an entitlement process, there's a year.
Right.
If you don't have to go through an entitlement process, you can run it a little faster. But if you have to get pre-sales,
right,
there's just not many pre-sales in the market right now. So that's a year process.
Right. So when you guys jumped into this, how did you sustain yourselves with cash flow other than you had your rental model, right? Did you actually have the construction model as part of your monthly cash flow model? Is that what sustained you as you started to build up into projects, or were you still keeping another job?
So what sustained us, we started really primarily as a development company.
Okay.
And so early in the existence of the company, the focus was solely to be the best developer,
right,
and use the big general contractors to take all the general contracting risk. And, you know, right, if they were only going to make a two percentage point fee, how in God's green earth would you ever want to take 20-some-odd million dollars of risk for $400,000 of profit?
Right.
But the truth is, reality we learned is when those guys stall and have a problem, you still have all the risk. And then you have a layer between you and the subcontractors and a layer between you. There's two ways to look at it. You have a layer of insulation of the problem to solve the problem, or you have a layer of interference to solve the problem.
Right.
I found it to feel more like it was interference.
And you could go directly with the problem and just get your way out of it.
Exactly. And right.
I've been there. We
kind of believed the more direct interaction gave us more control of delivering, right?
You know absolutely. I mean,
you look at the general contracting model.
Right.
A number of the big successful general contractors perform their own concrete. Why do they perform their own concrete? Because that's how they control,
yeah,
A, making money, but B, I would suggest more it mitigates the risk on the general contracting side and allows them to control schedule. It gives them more firsthand control. All these concrete buildings, the schedule is all driven through the concrete sub.
Absolutely.
So it gives them a second layer of control to protect themselves.
And if you're just a developer, you don't have that level, but once you're in there and you've got concrete guys working with you, you're in good shape.
Exactly. And then, you know, you look at of all the developers in the business, and, you know, there's a number of us and all relatively well known. None of us rank on the Forbes 500 list, but Matt and Dan Walsh do. So the general contractors seem to, A, know how to sustain their building, their business through generations. Walsh, 100 years old. Turner, 100 years
amazing,
old. Tishman,
isn't it? 100
years old. But you don't see too many developers that can maintain
their
business cycle.
The money goes so far because it's that energy cycle, like you. I mean, I can tell you get up and you're driven every day and you do what you got to do to make this work.
Yeah. Well, I would say they probably have some of that in the general contract. Well, but it's just interesting if you look at the...
Well, I'm saying, I know they do, but I'm just saying, but once that ends, if that doesn't carry on by your children,
right?
You know, it's different. You know, there. I mean, it seems to me in a contracting business, it's almost handed a cash flow business, where yours is you create your money.
True, but I mean, if you think in a contracting business, and maybe that is a little bit more of a facilitatable model and a little less volatility to the model, which I think maybe differentiates development from general contracting a bit, but you still got to go out and earn the next job.
You still got to find somebody.
Every one of them, right? Now, there tends to be more public work, which is probably a little more stable than the private work and a little less volatile than the private work. But. So it's interesting. But anyways, we started as a developer. Early on, we realized on the smaller deals, we were effectively the general contractor. We had a construction manager out there, and we were taking all the price risk. With the big general contractors, we weren't taking theoretically as much price risk, but there was always deals being made that we weren't involved in that were, of course, never to our benefit. That's why we weren't involved in them. That kind of inspired our thought process that we were better with direct control of the construction. We also staff a couple of the subcontractors. We staff a carpentry group now, which when you're seven-story buildings, it's a carpentry superstructure.
Yeah.
So we control our own destiny on those. There's some goods and some bads to that. And then we're also now, and early on, brought the design process in-house. So the idea was to facilitate an in-house design build. And that's still kind of an idea and a philosophy that is, you know, as close to what our core values are on how we want to do business. But it's not an easy. I think it's the right process and the best process, but not necessarily.
It seems like you always got to tweak it, because we're trying to bring the design part into us too, and it's hard. You got to keep tweaking it and keep tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it, and more spreadsheets and more. You know, it never ends.
You know, I'd say ultimately it comes down to the people, right?
Yeah.
There's a good general contractor, not because they have all the right systems in place, because they have the right leadership. Ultimately, it's the people and the leadership. So.
And their commitment to getting it done and getting it done right.
Exactly. And the more reps guys take together, the better they get it. You can have the right people and have not taken too many reps together, and it takes a while, right? The All-Star games don't look as good as the Super Bowl, right?
No, they don't, man.
So,
no, they don't.
I think it ultimately comes down to the people, keeping them in a process that's sensible, that they can believe in, and then...
Right. Loyalty, you've been using the same subcontractors for how many years?
Well, we move around a fair amount. You know, we have some guys that always seem to be able to win the business, and we have...
Is that through relationship, or is that actual bids?
They win it by bid, but, you know, they understand how to run their subcontracting business such that they can always win the bids, right? And some other guy, some other general contractor might not know how to manage those guys' quirks, right? Because we all have quirks and different things. And we're doing the deals we're active on right now that we're building are very middle market deals, a 60 unit, a 70 unit. They're not cast in place concrete. They're walk up. So our carpentry group leads that. And, you know, we have some subcontractors that are just absolute gold, and we have some others that are a real challenge.
Oh, yeah.
But I think on every job that happens, we always do tend to go out to the market competitively. We have our relationships, re-earn the relationship.
Yeah, I saw on your comp board up there, you guys are always, you know, well-priced in terms of where you are in the market, it looks like to me.
Yeah, well, and we try to pride it. We think our system can allow us to deliver the projects at a better basis than
because you got
other
more internal
in
control, hands-on control, rather than
and hopefully better information, so we're making better decisions throughout the process.
Right.
But again, that's only as good as the leaders we have in the company.
How many projects you got running right now?
We probably have 7 or 8. It's interesting.
You mean on the board? You got a couple that are in the works, a couple that are going.
Well, that's the magic. What do we mean by that? So maybe start at the newest, right? The project in River Forest, for sale condo project. We gained control of the land and the redevelopment agreement in the fourth quarter. We're out soft marketing. We're not on the MLS. We hope to get on the MLS probably mid first quarter. So we'll take a contract now, but we're going through a plan development process in the village, get approval for what we want to build, and starting our pre-sale process. Second project behind that, from newest to oldest, is our Erie and LaSalle deal. Mm-hmm. You and I spoke about that earlier.
Right.
A high-end for-sale condo, 31 units, priced from 1.2 to 3 million. We have about 10 or a third of them sold. We've demoed the site. We have our permit and we're ready to go.
Yeah,
so we're just ready to get started on construction on that.
The concept looks great on that, too.
It's pretty exciting in a really nice location in a really nice submarket, River North. And I think it being for sale versus apartment is we're positioned with the right right product type versus another apartment building right now in River North. After that, we have 3 that are all in some points of construction and or stabilization. They're all rental buildings, again, from newest to oldest, 301 West North, 69 units, Old Town, great building, just put the roof on it, trying to get rough inspections today to start finished drywall. We're going to deliver that in the spring. Then we have 1325 North Wells, a 60 unit, also a 7-story walk up. Both these buildings have off the charts rooftop amenity decks. I think we really took the amenities to another level on those. That one we're already drywalling. It's about a month or so ahead of the 301 deal.
Right.
It'll also deliver in the spring of next year. Then we have a 30 unit at 1545 West North Avenue. That one's in lease up. We have 28 out of 30 lease, so we're stabilized. Trying to get those last 2 done in what's always a tough winter rental market. We also have the retail there. We thought we had a bite with a physical therapy client a couple weeks ago, but it didn't get done, so we're out on the market. That's right off the feeder ramp of the Kennedy at North Avenue, so a very interesting retail play there. And then we just finished a deal at 55th and Kedzie, which was an LA Fitness and a strip center. And then we have our condo deal that was in our last cycle of deals, 17 unit plus retail. We sold all 17 units. We still have the retail, which is now leased. And then we have a couple deals that predate the downturn that we're still holding some rental units as we let that market recover on the for sale side.
So those you're just holding till the market changes, you make your decisions on what you're going to do,
and
see what happens.
And you know, now they're about 10 years old. They were all deals that were in good financial shape going into the downturn, so we were able to hold them through the price depreciation.
Right.
You know, the magic in real estate is...
You didn't have to keep throwing money into them to keep it...
Buy low and sell high, right?
Right.
We were fortunate not to have to sell those in the downturn and hold on to them, and now, of course... you have to start trying to work through issues of, do you have to renovate them and update them to make them look like today's standard, or can you sell them from 10 years ago standard? So those are the kind of issues we work with on those deals.
Well, your company is to be celebrated. You've created something really wonderful here. Your projects look great. Thank you for doing this podcast, and I'll see you at our next party.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Pat.
For more information about Marty Paris and Sedgwick Properties, you can visit him at sedgwickproperties.com. If you're interested in more information on how you can build or remodel your own custom project, you can visit us at sghomebuilders.com.